What's up, everybody? We got a special guest. I'm so excited. For those that don't know, my name is Ryan. We got another Ryan, so we're two Ryans deep, the best name on the face of the earth. And so we're super excited to introduce Ryan Hanley. Met him at an insurance conference long time ago.
At least a decade.
I mean, it's been a long time. I think it was when you were with Trust of Choice. I don't know. I don't remember.
Were you at that 2012 Young Agents National event in San Francisco?
I wasn't in San Francisco. I started going in Atlanta.
All right. So that was the next year, I think. Yeah. So that would have been when it was. Yeah.
Yep. In Atlanta. So that was 2013. So 12 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That- unless we met, well, we probably decade too. Yep. Out on the scene, probably about a decade too. Yeah, no, this dude, I'm so excited to be here, guys. I mean, I when you reached out about coming on, I was like, yeah, let's do it. I want to bullshit with these guys. Let's go. So I'm excited.
Well, you get the privilege, I guess. I don't know. We started this podcast and we're like, you know, we're not going to talk about any insurance. Insurance is boring. It sucks. I mean, it is. I mean, we make our living in it.
We make our living in it. We love it. We're just guys, really, really boring.
Well, we can talk about this too. It could be exciting, but I feel like there's a lot of lock-in. There's a lot of companies that make money by keeping it boring and keeping it slow. And I think that's why people think it's boring. I mean, obviously we're not selling like crypto or, you know, whatever, or anything like super fun, you know, t-shirts or some shit. But you know, it could be really exciting. Like there are, like if you go to the fringes of the industry, there's some really exciting stuff happening, but right. It's just the major players in our space intentionally keep them on the fringes because that's how they make their money. And I don't fault them for that. That's capitalism and that's humanity, but it's also true.
Yeah. No,
we were having a conversation last night about it, about how change is hard. And a lot of people, we've always done it this way. And my counter to that is, look, well, that doesn't matter that you've always done it this way. You either evolve or you die. Like you've got to constantly be getting better at what you do and finding better ways to meet people where they want to be met. Like with education, for example, the traditional way of doing education is slowly dying on the higher education level. People are now wanting to get their content through online platforms and learn online that meets them where they are, because most people are going back to college after having children are getting a job or going through something. They can't sit on a campus from 8 to 4 the way a lot of us did. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, we got to evolve.
Yeah, I think too, Wes, I think we're starting to, as a society, we're starting to realize how important hands-on work is, like being involved in the thing. Mm-hmm. And college completely detaches you from that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went to a top 30 liberal arts school, right? University of Rochester. It was filled with idealistic, you know, liberal arts majors. And basically, I didn't realize I just went there because they gave me the most money to play baseball. I was poor as shit. So whoever gave me the most money was where I was going. I mean, that's a story for another time I can tell you. But that's why I went there. But I showed up and I didn't realize it's a safety school for rich, dumb kids that couldn't get into Ivy Leagues. That's who goes to the University of Rochester. So, you know, you got all these ridiculous majors and, you know, all the cliche, ridiculous, stupid majors. They have some really good schools. Their engineering school and their medical school are fantastic. But like the rest of the college is basically like useless. And you get no hands-on. You're not touching anything hands-on. You're not talking to people that are doing the work on a day-to-day basis. The people that are teaching you are not in the work, right? I think that's why business school hasn't seen the same decline or the same, hasn't gotten the same negative fodder that a standard liberal arts school has, is because most business schools, the people teaching have either previously, you know, started companies or been investment bankers or whatever, work for McKinsey. And then they come in and they have real hands-on training and they can actually do projects and it's much more, you're in the work. The standard 4-year liberal arts education where you sit in a classroom and learn about stuff is pretty much useless today. I mean, it's you know, unless the field you're going into demands a college degree, which I think is insane for 90% of employers to demand a college education today, you are missing massive portions of the talent market. You know, I just don't know how it's useful.
Yeah. I would agree. I don't, And Clancy, I mean, our son is 8, and he keeps saying he's not going to go to school.
Yeah.
He wants to do a trade. That's what he would be perfect at, is a trade, whether it's mechanicking or owning your own plumbing or electrical business. I mean, I got plenty of contractors that I insure that never went to school, and they're doing just fine.
Yeah, it's and frankly, those might be the only jobs left by the time he's in the market. Yeah. You know, when you really think about it, the last jobs to go are going to be the people who can actually fix the things and make the things and, you know, repair the thing. Like, those are going to be the only people left, because, you know, I'll tell you, I've thought about this in my own career, right? Like, much of my career is information based or leadership based, right? I mean, it's soft topics, soft skills. And I love it. I love doing it. But at the same time, like, I could take everything I've ever written or created, every video I've done, drop it into a custom GPT. You know, let's say I take all the stuff I've ever done in insurance, right? Let's say I could go back and take the Agency Nation articles and the stuff I write for all the different places, put them in one GPT and gave people access to it. They'd have 90% of my brain right there. They might not have what my personal feelings are now and into the future, because obviously AI, you know, isn't going to be able to do that. They may be able to try to predict, but it wouldn't know. But everything I've ever said, taught, trained, done in the past, they could have full access to in a finger snap with a prompt. And then what is the value of, you know, the value of teaching that, I think, just changes. I think things like in-person workshops, I think, you know, conferences, events, while many of them are still being done completely wrong and horribly, I do think that industry is going to see a resurgence, because when AI content generation becomes the norm, we're going to be on platforms like LinkedIn or wherever going, is this really Ryan, or is this his AI? And so I think that being in the same space with a person is going to start to have a premium. So I think, you know, things like being able to perform on stage, communicate your message, interact with people, be charismatic, engaging, draw people in, like those type of hard in-person skills that it takes to really build an audience and engage people, those people will, as educators and information product creators, I think will continue to be successful. But the faceless online, you know, 297 course guy, I don't know how much that lasts either.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, any time, like going through the conferences with the Big Eye or even our state conferences, it at some point it's like you hear the same stuff over and over and over and over and over. But more recently, it's all on AI, ChatGPT, and those platforms that are just really taking its part in today's world, whether it's in the insurance business or in any other business. And it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, Anthropic just came out with a study. I'm going to pull it up so I don't misquote it here. I actually did a post on it the day that we're recording this on LinkedIn. But 40% of all U.S. employees now report using AI daily in their work.
That's
40%. Okay, that's a huge number. That's double from 2 years ago. 2 years ago, that number has doubled in 2 years, right? That's only going to get more. And the point of the article that I wrote was, and this is what Anthropic found in this study that I thought was the most interesting part, is we're seeing the same adoption concentration that has happened with previous technologies, right? So like certain types of people, certain types of businesses tend to gravitate towards this. And now the expertise, the ability to extract efficiency and effectiveness out of those tools, it's concentrating in certain businesses and in certain types of people, et cetera. But the difference is it's happening much faster. So, you know, whether you're in the insurance business or not, you know, whatever you do in listening to this, my point is, where I think you could be late on, you know, the early internet, early social media, early content creation, you know, VoIP, APIs, you could be late on all those things. And as soon as you implemented the technology, you caught up immediately, right? So like, let's say you were a carrier and you didn't have any API technology. You know, you just were, maybe this is maybe 10 years ago. Most do today, to varying degrees of sophistication, but we'll say, most today, most have some form of API, some form of way of pushing and pulling information. 10 years ago, that wasn't the case, right? So, but the minute that carrier decided to add API technology, they, in a finger snap, caught up to all their competitors that had done it earlier, right? They immediately had the technology. They could offer the same services, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know that that's true with AI. Now, this is my feeling, so take this for what it is, but this is what I've been talking about with people when they ask me, is that my personal feeling is you can't wait on this, because what's going to happen is I'm going to get so good and so efficient at creating content that drives influence, building systems into my business that creates efficiency, being able to stack cash because I only need 3 employees when you need 10, right? Mm-hmm. And what are you going to do? You're going to fire 7 people overnight to get to my 3, right? I can deploy. So my point in saying this is, if you wait too long on AI to implement it, you don't finger snap catch up to your competitors. You now are that same percentage behind them. Just now you're doing it as well, right? You're not falling behind as fast, but you're certainly not catching up to them, because once you get a feel for how AI works, the ability to rapidly add efficiencies is logarithmically scales, right? You get better at a logarithmic rate, not a linear rate or even an exponential rate. So I think that's something people really need to be aware of and cognizant of, that this is not a technology I believe you can sleep on.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think those that are going to be behind substantially, at least in our business, in the insurance business, but probably, I would assume, in any business.
Yeah. Yeah. And this could look like, even for your plumbing and your contracting businesses, this looks like automating your lead generation process, automating and being mm-hmm. able to handle service questions, scheduling, like these types of things that you may have otherwise needed an admin or receptionist for, and then maybe you were, however you were doing in the past, right? Now, if you're getting to spend, if instead of 6 hours of your day were spent on a project doing work, and 2 hours or 3 hours was spent doing admin, scheduling, talking to clients, doing estimates, right? If you mm-hmm. have a automated lead generation system, so like a system running your ads that drives them to a form that then, and you have, I've seen some tools in the landscaping field where there's tools now that can, just based on a few pictures or even Google images, they can create estimates for the landscaping, like almost automatically, very easily. So if you take that time, where maybe 2 hours of your day was spent on admin and 6 was on actually doing the work, and even if you dropped it by an hour, how much are you making over the course of an entire year if you get an extra hour back every day to do the work that you do? Mm-hmm. And, that's where I think, I think you can go both growth with AI, or you can go efficiency in your business. But either way, starting to kind of FAFO this stuff is going to produce massive margins for those who move early.
I mean, using the math that you there, again, an hour a day, that's 250 hours a week on a 50-week year. That's 6 extra weeks of work that you're getting that somebody else is not. So if, Kobe always, I love Kobe Bryant. Like, he was one of my favorites because he played when I was
Kobe's a man.
A young adult. And he always talked about, listen, if I get up at 4 and work out at 5 and then come back and work out at 9, and I come back and work at 2 and then do it again at 8, I'm getting 4 workouts in a day where a guy might only get 1. He goes, you stack that over 5 years, they can never catch me. No matter how much they work over the last of their career, I will have outworked them. And that's kind of the theory there, right? You stack that work and all of a sudden you become uncatchable.
Who was the guy in the NBA? And I cannot believe I'm forgetting his name. He was part of Boston's Big 3 when they won. He's the guy that said anything is possible.
Kevin Garnett.
Okay. So Kevin Garnett has a story from the first time he played on the Olympic basketball team with Kobe, right? And he's like, we got there and we had practice and then we had an off day. So we all went out to the club. He's like, we're coming in from the club at 3 o'clock in the morning, And Kobe is sitting in the lobby drenched in sweat because he just got his first workout in for the day. Kevin Garnett said that completely changed the way he approached the rest of his career, was because he's like, I walked in at 3 a.m. and, you know, they'd been at the club. And here's this guy who he's going to be playing with the next day, who is already dripping in sweat from his first workout. And he's like, it absolutely blew my mind. And I think he even goes on to say, I never got to Kobe level of crazy workouts, but he said it definitely completely changed how he approached his time, how he approached how he worked out, because it just blew his mind that here's a guy, I'm one of the best players in the NBA, and this dude is that much more committed and ahead of me in terms of understanding how time stacks and compounding.
It's like Malcolm Gladwell talks about the 10,000 hours. You've got to put the time in to be great at something. And the more time you put in, the greater you become, because it becomes second nature. You don't think about it anymore. I mean, my two boys are playing basketball and they're shooting free throws. Like, you've got to shoot so many free throws that whether your heart rate's at 140 or it's at 70, it's the same motion. It's the same thought. You're not even thinking about it. You're just shooting it because your body just knows that it goes that far and you can make it without thinking. And it doesn't matter if there's, you know, 8 minutes left in the quarter, or there's 0.8 of a second left in the game. It's just, you're not thinking. It's just, you're just shooting.
Yeah,
and that's how it has become.
There's actually a really cool like derivative of the 10,000 hour rule that I like from Naval Ravikant, and he said 10,000 hours is great, but 10,000 iterations is the super hack, right? And what he meant by that was 10,000 hours of doing the same thing makes you really good at one thing, but 10,000 hours of constantly iterating on what you're doing gets you there even faster and even farther. Meaning, are you playing with your foul shot? Are you taking foul shots from maybe a half inch farther back and seeing, does that improve your hit rate? Is it more weight on your shooting foot? Is it a more balanced approach? Is it a high release? Is it a low? He's like, it's not just shooting 10,000 shots. It's 10,000 iterations in that time as well. Allows you to pinpoint exactly what makes you like the most efficient and effective at the thing that you do. And I thought that was a wonderful like build on the 10,000 hour rule, because it really gets your brain going like, okay, like, am I just swinging my, you know, if, like we were talking about golf before we went live, right? Am I just going to the range and getting an hour in at the range? Or am I working on, okay, what happens if I pull my hands a little farther inside? What if I let them drift a little? What if I, you know, go a little steeper with my short, you know, it's not just taking 100 swings for an hour at the range. It's what are those at, you know, if you want to go even deeper, what are you doing with those 100 swings that you take, you know, in that time? And, this is the level of, in depth of thought that I think, if you want to be truly elite at anything, you kind of have to think at this level of depth. And one of the things that I've found surprising in my career, and Wes, I think our brains probably work very alike. You were talking about not being able to settle and constantly needing a project. And, you know, I have a feeling that probably means your brain, you have some form of attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity, whatever. I got diagnosed with, pretty severe ADHD about 3 years ago. And for those of you who have followed my content, that's probably not a big surprise. But, you know, it was nice for it to be official. Cause I had always just thought, like, I mean this with full sincerity. I had always just thought I was kind of crazy. Like, I just thought, like, you know, like, I get these thoughts, I get these ideas, I share them, you know, especially in the insurance industry, which doesn't really want to hear new ideas. At least it didn't for a long time. I feel like today it's a little more receptive, but a decade ago, 15 years ago, when I first started sharing content.
You were ahead of your time by 10 years easy.
Yeah, I used to get heckled. Talking about YouTube marketing, I used to get heckled at insurance conferences. That's a real thing. Like, I've had guys yell at me. I've had guys get up and leave. Talking about YouTube marketing, just so we're clear, not politics, not anything. YouTube marketing, right? So just to give it clear. But I always just thought I was crazy, right? I was just like, oh, my brain, I don't know. Everyone else doesn't seem to think this way. So maybe I'm the one that's nuts, and come to find out it's true technically. But what was good about it, this is where I'm going with this, is when I did finally get like an official diagnosis, what it did for me was, in my brain, it allowed me to go, okay, how do I use this to my advantage? So instead of just this being this thing that I deal with on a day-to-day basis, right? Where, you know, there's a ton of pros to it. There are also a ton of cons if you don't know what you're dealing with. I could start to shave off the rough edges of the cons, right? And lean into the advantages of the mm-hmm. of the disorder. And here's the interesting part. And this is to your point, Wes, you were talking about, I know the audience didn't hear this. We were talking about in the green room. I'll paraphrase what you're saying, which essentially your wife was like, why are you constantly taking on more new stuff, right? And this is a theory. Everyone's listening. This is a theory, not my theory, but this is a theory of why our brains evolve this way. Because while, you know, there's a ton of debate right now around autism and vaccines, and I don't want to get into that. And frankly, I don't have enough education. I have my opinions, but I'm not a doctor, so I literally am not going to share those opinions. ADHD is very different. It is a type of neurodiversity, but it's not, they haven't linked it really. The linkage to any type of thing that we've done as a society is very, very loose, unlike some forms of autism. Mm-hmm. Where, so what they did was they said, okay, well, if it's not brought on by our society, what we're doing, what we're eating or what we're putting in our body, then what is it? And, mm-hmm. you know, the most prominent accepted theory today is that ADHD actually evolved in the hunters. So hunters, those who went out into the world, or warriors, those who went out to battle other tribes, right? This is hundreds of thousands of years ago as we evolved, right? Our brains were built to take in chaos and not have it impact us, right? So where I call them normies, right? So where a normie gets two or three or four inputs and goes, oh my God, this is too much. I'm overwhelmed. I can't handle it, right? Someone with ADHD is like, give me all the inputs. I want them all. Right? How many, you got more inputs? I'll take all the inputs, right? And it doesn't phase us. And people look at us and they're like, what the hell is wrong with you? Like, how could you be, you know, doing this and this and this? And it's like, I'm like, you don't even see anything wrong with it, right, Wes? I mean, you like, you do these things and you're like, well, what else would I do? I mean, of course I'm going to do another thing. Like, of course.
Right? And of course, we're going to start a podcast.
Right. And it's really cool. The research is really cool. I encourage anyone who's interested to go in and do some searches on this, but it's basically an evolutionary, because about 20% of the population has ADHD. 39% of all entrepreneurs have ADHD. Okay. 39% of all entrepreneurs. And when you think about that, it makes a lot of sense. Yes. Because in order to be an entrepreneur, you have to be able to handle a massive amount of chaos in order to be successful. And, you know, so I guess my point, if there is one in this diatribe, this was more educational than informational, but was more like, I think if you are that type of person, don't fight it, right? You got to have guardrails, otherwise you drive yourself nuts, right? And your spouse or partner or whoever nuts, but, and the people in your life. But, it's not something we should fight. It's something we should embrace. And mm-hmm. because it is a superpower that others don't have. There are things that I literally am horrible at because of this as well. But, you know, there are also certain things that we're very good at. And I think we need to lean into those and not fight them. Don't think you're wrong or bad. I'm not saying you do, Wes, but just people in general. There's a lot of stigma around ADHD. I know the first time I talked about it on my podcast, I got all these, I can't believe you're talking about this. Some people are like, you're crazy, because people want to do business with you. Other people are like, this is so brave. And I'm like, it's neither one of those things. It's just reality. I mean, this is just right. who I am. And I think it's important that we don't allow the stigma to stop us, but we have to be aware of it and embrace it and understand there are absolutely things that can cause problems in your life if you're not aware that you are that this is what's going on. But you can manage those very effectively.
How do you manage those? Because I get your emails, you know, I see them, I read them, I sent it to Wes to see if he was getting them. But it's, I enjoy reading those emails, but you can tell your thought process, you know, so how do you manage?
Yeah. So
that ADHD,
it's a good question. The most tactical way is time blocking. It's not sexy. But if it's like I said to you, Ryan, like I didn't get a calendar invite, which may have been my fault, right? But I didn't have a calendar invite for this. So I didn't even know we were recording. I mean, once you said it, I was like, oh shit. I mean, I 100% remembered having the conversation, but it wasn't on my calendar. So in my mind, it did not exist, because what I realized is that I can't trust my mind to remember that thing. If it's not on the calendar, it doesn't happen. So like if I'm going to write, right, I put in my calendar, you know, focus time, or, you know, I use focus time is what I use, but you can just block out a time, writing time, whatever, content time, or if you need to balance your books at the end of the month, right? Take 4 hours on a Friday, block them, do that work. Otherwise, it doesn't get done, because the way a hyperactive mind works is it's the next thing, next thing, next thing, next thing. You're just, you're a problem solver. You're a, you know, one of my early issues when I ascended to leadership position was I wanted to move at 1,000 miles an hour because that's how fast I move. And I expected, because I was unaware of the way that my brain being different than other people at that time, I expected everyone to just keep pace. And I got a lot of pushback. I got a lot of negative feedback from my team, because they're like, they just don't move that way. They don't think that way. And at first I bristled to it, right? I'm like, you know, I tried to not be aggressive about it, but in my mind I'm like, catch the fuck up. Like, what is wrong with you? Like, let's go. Yeah. Like, we're trying to get shit done. We're trying to take over the world, right? Like, let's go. And it wasn't so much that they didn't want that. They did. It was just, quite frankly, they couldn't take in 30 inputs at once. Now, I couldn't slow down and do detail work. Detail work is very, very, very difficult for me. Like, it's like, I'm a really good deal maker. I am terrible. Once the deal is made, all the like checkbox bullshit that has to get done to actually like get ink on paper, it causes me physical pain to have to slow down and do that work. Yeah, so, right? So in every business that I've had, you know, the last decade or so, I have someone that I work with that does that stuff, because it's not that I don't want to do it. It's not that I think it's beneath me, which I've been accused of by people who don't understand, right? It's that will take me 2 hours when it will take someone else 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Or it'll take me an entire day when it'll take someone else 30 minutes. Because it literally, like, my brain can't slow down. Like, in my mind, it's already done. Deal made. They agreed. We have terms. It's in an email. Bam. Let's move on. Right? Like, that's the way. And
then it's like, oh, no, we need these signed documents.
Yes. Yeah. And you're like, whoa, they already said yes. Like, why do we? Let's go. Yeah, let's go. So to answer your question, dude, what I came up with was I like to come up with these little acronyms and frameworks. I you know, mental models, reframes, whatever you want to call them, aphorisms, as reminders. So like, you know, the one that I've been using for the last few years, I've been writing about it a lot at Finding Peak lately, is this idea. It's where the name Finding Peak came from, which is, this idea of peak, which is presence, energy, awareness, and calibration. So if I am approaching a task like this podcast, right, I want to be present. I want to make sure that I'm present right here. So I have, like, normally I'd have my text messages up on my screen on my right. I'd have my email going or whatever I'm working on my big screen on my left, right? And then I have this screen for video calls that we're talking into. And if this were, like, some bullshit meeting, I would probably be doing things on both these screens while the meeting was going on. But I want to be very present for you guys. So I've turned those things down and I've said, okay, I'm going to commit to my time with Ryan and Wes to be 100% present. Okay, bam, presence. I'm present in the moment. I can be focused for this moment. Okay, where's my energy? If I'm hungover, if I'm tired, if we were doing this at 3 p.m., my performance would be worse because my energy wouldn't be at a place where I could give you 100% of myself. So especially for people who have hyperactivity or ADD, you want to make sure that in the most important moments of your day, whatever those are, you are aware of your energy cycles. Now, some people have more energy in the afternoon. Some people have more energy, and there's different types of energy, right? I don't like working out in the morning. I don't have max physical energy for me first thing in the morning. I have max mental energy. So I want to do any podcast, any call before 1 p.m., right? Any 1 p.m. and earlier, my most important meetings or my most important calls or a podcast, anything that needs to happen in that regard, That needs to happen before one, because I'm essentially useless from a decision-making capacity after 1 o'clock. Just my energy, it drops mentally. But what's weird for me is my physical energy goes. So in the afternoon is when I want to work out. Okay, so knowing your energy level. So are you scheduling your most important things, sales calls, whatever, meetings with your team, in the moments where you have the most energy, and are you managing it? Okay, awareness. What is going on in my world right now? Right? Did I just get a really shitty message about, you know, a client or something? Is my ex-wife giving me hell? Is there something going on with my kids that's frustrating me? Am I just, you know, do I have, is there 10 million thoughts going on? Is my environment set up to be present and be mm-hmm. give you my best effort right now, right? So am I aware of what's happening around me, my feelings, my emotions? Am I coming in with a positive attitude? Am I coming in with a negative attitude? Like aware of your surroundings and where you are mentally. And then the last, the K stands for calibration, which is, you know, do I have methods for when I feel like my presence is off or my energy is off, or I'm aware of something that's going on that's keeping me from doing my best work? Do I have a way to recalibrate back to the state that I want to be in? So that feels like a lot. And it's not, I don't use it as like this workbook that I go through and I'm like, are you present? Is your energy? I mean, I used to do that, but now it's kind of second nature to where, you know, I turn the lights off. I make, like I said, make sure my screens are down. I have one small monitor camera that allows me to look directly at you guys. So I'm 100% here. And then like, I got these two moron kittens that my kids made me get that are running around right now in the background being, you know, and my calibration is I just keep coming. I keep, every time my head kind of turns, I just go, hey, stay present in the moment. I come back to it, whatever. I mean, that's a small recalibration, but you know, it may be, right. it may be, hey, if you show up, let's say you have a really important call at 11, and then I'll shut up here, guys. I'll just give you this example. So I find that short ruck walk. So I have a 40-pound ruck vest that I wear. I find short, like 20, 30 minute ruck walks bring me back really quick. So let's say I wake up, feel like shit, or whatever, something's off, and I just can't focus. I got 10 things going on, and I know I need to get this important thing out, but I can't. One of my personal recalibration methods is I'll just say, fuck it. I'll stop what I'm doing. I'll throw my vest on. I'll go for my quick 30 minute loop around my neighborhood, come back, and I inevitably will be able to lock in. So it's figuring out what those things are for you. It may be 10 pushups. It may be just going, you know, sitting down with a book. It may be, you know, I have no problem. Like, and I know I'm ripping here, but I'll be quiet in a sec. I had an,
you're good, man. You're good.
I had a team member at Rogue Risk that, I got a call one day from, one of the managers who was like, so-and-so is playing video games in the middle of the day. I said, okay, you know, I'll give him a call. It was a dude. So I called him and I said, what's up? Talking to me. And I said, hey, you know, I heard that you're playing video games. Someone called you playing video games in the middle of the day and, you know, whatever. And he said, yeah. And I go, okay, well, talk me through that. You know, talk me through, because we were fully remote, right? Talk me through that. Now, one caveat to this story, guys, is he never missed his numbers. Never mm-hmm. didn't hit his sales numbers for the month, okay? So I said, you know, just what's up? And he's like, you know, after like 3 hours of like getting in the morning, I like to just, I'll play a half hour. He liked to play like Madden or something. It was like a sports game. I think it was football. I can't exactly remember. It was like Madden or baseball or one of those. And he's like, I go play for a half hour. I come back. I'm like ready to rock again. So like his recalibration, instead of a smoke break or going for a walk or whatever, was 30 minutes of video games, brought him back in. He's now refocused, ready to go. And he goes and pounds the phone again for another couple hours. So do I really care that in the middle of the day, he's playing 30 minutes of video games to recalibrate himself, when at the end of the month, what really matters is that he's hitting his sales numbers? I don't care.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter to me. So it's, that's not my recalibration, you know, and you know, it made me a little nervous because I felt like it opened, you know, it opens the door to like spending a whole day playing video games. But again, if your goal, if you're managing to KPIs and not activity, it doesn't matter, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. You two keep talking. My bladder's not working.
Well, you mentioned earlier about the frustrations of like getting the signed paperwork. Do you ever read or listen to Patrick Lencioni? He has something called Working Genius.
I don't know that name. No.
He's a management consultant. He's called the Table Group. He just moved to Nashville, and he has something called Working Genius, and it stands for WIDGET. So it's Wonder, Invention, Discernment, Galvanizing, Enablement, and Tenacity. We all have two working geniuses, two working competencies, and two working frustrations. So for me, like mine are G&E, so galvanizing and enablement. And enable, it's not what you think, like you enable people to take drugs. It's like there's another piece to it. It's like you're galvanizing people, are able to bring people around an idea and then kind of engage them into getting that done. But the tenacity piece is something like getting it across the finish line. Like my wife is really good at tenacity. Like that's her working genius. And it works really well with me because I'm a big picture guy. Like I love the art of the close, the art of like trying to get somebody to say yes, even though they don't want to say yes. But man, when it's time to sign paperwork, I'm like, ugh. Like, yep. Let me get you in touch with somebody to get that across the paper line because I'm not good at it. Like it just like you mentioned, it really kind of pulls me down and not into a happy place. I'll do it, but I don't enjoy it. And so you mentioned it. It's just something that kind of stuck with me when you mentioned the frustrations you and Tumi both about how you don't like to do that. And he's a management consultant. He's got a podcast.
Yeah, no, I'm going to check it out. I love that. I think that's completely true. And you know, I'd say one of the biggest awakenings for me as a person, not just the ADHD thing, has been this double into it. And I first heard this in all fairness from Gary Vaynerchuk, Gary V. You know, he was one of the first people that I saw talking about double into your strengths. Don't try to raise your weaknesses. Right. So, and I firmly believe in this. I think for a long time, like, you know, so if you think of life like a video game, right? Like you have, you know, you're picking your avatar, right? And your power or speed or whatever, right? In a video game. And you can think of yourself as a video game avatar in whatever position you're in. What are the things that you are the strongest at? And what are the things that you're weakness at? And for a long time, the way it was, we were taught, bring your weaknesses up. Right. If you're not a great communicator, get better at communication. If you're not great now, to a certain extent, this is true in so much as those skills fit the job function that you need to perform. OK, right. So in all fairness, if your job involves massive communication and you're a shitty communicator, you got to fix that or you're in the wrong job. Yeah. But that, you know, let's say you're in a, let's take a leader of an insurance agency, right? So let's say you got 20 people working for you, you're a $3 to $5 million agency in revenue, and you got a nice shop, and you're the leader of an agency. One of the things that I think is unique about the insurance industry that most leaders struggle with is, are you going to be the leader, the CEO, the president, or are you going to be insert the best at a certain function?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what I see in insurance a lot is the skill stack of who usually is the agency principal clearly aligns to the sales function.
Yeah.
Right? Clearly aligns to the sales function. And then just they started the agency, they have the equity, whatever, they're also the agency owner. And I think that that's fine until you hit about $1 million in revenue. And from $1 million plus, if you really want to scale efficiently and effectively without frustration, if you want to scale and actually be able to have a life, like reap the benefits of this amazing career that you chose, agent, you know, running an agency, being the leader and the best salesperson means you are doing a disservice to your business. You can't be great at either if you are trying to be both. And what and that doesn't mean you have to, you know, and then a lot of guys and gals, although seemingly I feel like women have a better, I think it has to do with ego. They have a little better, women are just a little less naturally egotistical. I think they tend to see this a little sooner. But men, we really struggle with it, right? Like we want to be the man, right? I want people calling me, you know, my Hanley Insurance is on the outside of the business. I'm Hanley. So, you know, you need to talk, right? So we, you know, we get that ego going, but if you truly want to do the right thing for your business, it's if you are just an exceptional networker and you're charismatic and you can close deals with your eyes closed and people just love working with you, why would you waste a single minute on CEO responsibilities? Mm-hmm. Why? You're a killer. It doesn't mean you don't own all the equity. It doesn't mean that you don't, you don't, you're not the chairman of the board and you don't ultimately make the decisions, but it, you need to find someone who can run your business as a CEO. If you're like me, and while I can sell, I don't think I'm an exceptional salesperson necessarily. I also, you know, I don't define myself as a salesperson. So for me, I'm much more comfortable giving up. And I got a ton of shit for this. When I made a post back in 2021, I was about a year and a half into Rogue, and I posted on LinkedIn about the fact that I wasn't selling anymore. Stop selling, stop taking sales calls. And blah, 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 you know, all the stuff that they, you know, go, how are you going to know what's happening in your business? You know what? You're not, you know, you don't think you're good. I mean, all this stupid shit. And the answer was, I probably at that time still was the best salesperson. I eventually hired a couple guys and gals actually that blew way past me. So that's what I wanted. But like, I probably still was. However, where my skill sets land and what I can show up and be tenacious at, et cetera, was running the business, was managing the technology, working on the systems, handling culture, dealing with carriers. Like, that's the stuff that I needed to do. So I gave up the sales responsibility to do that. So it's figure out what your strengths are, double into those strengths and allow them with the role that you play, outsource all the rest, and don't give a shit about your weaknesses.
Yeah.
Don't look at your weaknesses as weaknesses. Just look at them as things that you need to outsource. Just, mm-hmm. It's not your zone of genius. Find someone who's it is.
Central Texas, that's the epitome of that. Like he hires people to do the things he doesn't want to do and doesn't like doing, and he's going to be the big picture guy and try to find ways to help the agency grow. And you would never know who they were. He purposely stays under the radar. Like he doesn't want anybody to know who he is and what he does, but he is built up. What you're saying, he is the epitome of that right there. And he does not get in the way. He lets people do what they're great at. And then he hires them and says, listen, this is your job. Go do it. I'm your backboard to stop you in the event that it's going to hurt us or hurt the company. But otherwise, I'm not going to bother you.
Yeah.
And he's grown it to a massive agency that no one knows about.
Well, that's the thing is you got to figure out what you want, right? Like, do you want a massive agency? You're not going to be able to do that being an agency owner and have a life, right? So there's right. Something's got to give. So if you're going to be number one service person, give every client your text, your cell phone number, because you think somehow that's good service, which is bananas. And you're going to try to run, you're just not going to grow as fast as you could. You may still grow. I'm not saying you won't, but you're not going to grow as fast as you can. And you're not going to have the life, because every single guy that I know who is giving out their cell phone number and is still trying to sell and is still taking service calls from their important clients and trying to run a business, they are miserable. Their weekends are filled. They can't golf. They can't, you know, they're not coaching their kids' sports team. They're miserable. They're working all the time. And yeah, their agency might be doing well, but their personal life is miserable. This hit me like a ton of bricks when I remember this, it was like a Tuesday in July. It was definitely a Tuesday. I think it was July or August. I looked at my calendar, show up to Rogue, you know, log in for the day and look at my calendar. I have one 30-minute meeting at 2 p.m. That's my whole day. Everything, the rest of my day is wide open. And I'm like, okay. So I messaged on Slack my head admin, and I was like, hey, what's going on? She goes, oh yeah, we don't need you today. Just go golfing or something. I go, what? She goes, oh yeah, everything's great. There's no problems. She goes, we don't need you. I go, what about this meeting? She goes, yeah, we took you off that meeting because we don't need you there. You're good. Like, we know what you want. Like, we're good. She's like, we'll have the wrap-up meeting on Friday. She's like, but you're good today. I was like, well, what about this meeting at 2? She's like, yeah, you probably don't need to be there either. She's like, I go golfing. And I was like, holy shit. Like, this is the dream. Like, I didn't plan on it, but I'm going to play 9. I think I went to the gym. I went and played 9. I did my grocery shopping. Came, you know, I'm texting on the site. Everything good. Everything's good. I'm like, this is pretty amazing. This, you know, I did some work in the afternoon or whatever, but I was like, think about that. Like, the business was growing. The business was working, right? Policies were getting written. Marketing was getting done. Customers were getting serviced. You know, accounting was getting done. It just didn't need to get done by me because I had removed myself from enough of those processes. And that particular day, the things that I did just none of that needed to get done that day. And I get a free day. And think about, you know, I come back, I show up on Wednesday, and, you know, we had a pretty full day that day and we got after it, but your energy's back, you're feeling good, you're feeling fulfilled. And like, that to me is how you move a business forward, not this 24 hours a day grind, hustle bullshit. It's just, that is a very small season. There's a very small season of a business in your career where you need to be that 18 hour a day person. If you're still doing that as you evolve into your career 5, 7, 10 years, you are not killing the game. You are doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. So what are you doing now?
Yeah, so now I am the president of a company called Encora. We are an AI data manufacturing company specifically for the insurance industry, meaning what we're trying to do is solve the data quality problem. It's my premise that this industry has been run by incredibly smart people for a very long time. And we have, for the most part, within a few standard deviations, squeezed out as much margin as we can in the current model. And what I see as the lowest hanging fruit for extracting additional margin out of our industry, from everyone from a carrier to an agent, is in data quality and the efficiency of data transfer. Meaning, the more information you know quicker and the more accurate that information is, the faster you can move and the less time and energy you have to take moving that data around different systems. So what does that look like in practice? Everything in commercial insurance, for anyone who's written it, knows that NAICS code is the starting place. And if you get NAICS code wrong, industry class, if you don't know NAICS, but if you get the industry class wrong to start, everything else downstream from that is fucked. Everything, right? Your applications, the questions you ask, who you submit it to, on and on and on and on. And this can be a landscaping company that also does tree service. This can be, you know, packaging a single family office in the same NAICS code as an investment bank. There's a million examples of what this looks like. But we solved NAICS code first. So we are now as or more accurate than any other tool that exists in NAICS code classification. And now we are doing the same thing for revenue and number of employees. In addition, what we've done is basically take the standard large data sets that that our industry uses, Equifax, Experian, Dun & Bradstreet, et cetera. And then when you apply the AI algorithms and small language models that we've created on top of those data sets with data that we either create or scrape ourselves, we're able to increase data accuracy by 20 to 25%. So if say, you know, so our clients tend to be MGAs, regional carriers, wholesale brokers, and large brokers. We could offer this to small agents, but they won't pay for it, don't appreciate it, and just end up yelling at us. So we're not offering it to them right now necessarily. I love you guys. I would love to offer it to you, but I can't take another one of the 200 pieces of data that you sent me was wrong, and therefore you guys suck and your data's wrong email again. Like, this is the, this, you want to know why small agents don't have nice tools? I'm going to tell you exactly why. And guys, I love you. I love you. My entire career.
We're at a larger agency.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, say, you know, 15 people and below, right? Like, most of my career has been dedicated to helping those agencies adopt the methodologies, tools, marketing, sales processes to scale.
To be fair, probably 90% of the agencies out there fit that mold.
Yes. Yes. Right. So, okay. So we started offering this as a $25 a month app that you could go in and buy and use. And this happened over and over, right? We're delivering this data to them. Hey, you got a new lead. So with name, a business, and address, we can give you all the firmographics, NAICS classification, COPE data, property data, OSHA data, transportation data, on and on. And we can give you it all. Name, a business, address. It's all you need. You get all that information, okay? In some cases, it's like 200, 300 data points. You may not need them all, but we give them to you. I got an email on a Monday morning. This was about 3 months ago that went, I did a search and the revenue number was wrong. You guys, your data sucks. You guys are terrible. And I'm canceling the service. Okay. Now I went in and looked. He was right. The revenue number was off. Okay. The other 72 pieces of data that we delivered to him, everything from number of employees, payroll, square footage of the building, on and on and on, all of them were accurate. So one piece of data to a small agent, your product sucks. if I did that same thing to a carrier, right? They're offering to name, you know, that executive is offering to name their next child Lincora. So it's, you know, when you look at like where the value is, and again, guys, I love you, but like the myopicness of small agents drives me nuts, and it's so difficult to sell to them, and they won't pay anything for anything. So it's like, that's why all the cool tools like start with small agents, and then they all have the same exact experience, and then they all go upstream as fast as they can. And yeah, it's why the big agents have all the good tools and the small agents don't, is that. And guys, I love you. I'm not saying that to be negative. It's just the reality. So, so that's what, so most of my time is spent there. I also have a kind of media and coaching company called Finding Peak. That's where the newsletter that you were referencing before, go to findingpeak.com if you guys are interested. I just talk about all the things that I've learned over my career, and then, you know, do some programs with people occasionally. I have a 6-week intensive workshop that I'm going to be doing on, it's called Finding Peak Influence. So how leaders, you know, create the content strategies to become influential, either with, you know, their teams internally or externally as thought leaders, which I think is becoming more and more necessary that you have some sort of thought leadership or individual who is a thought leader in your business consistently sharing. So it's things like that. And I do some kind of one-on-one coaching on the side as well.
Nice. So every podcast we start out with rapid fire questions.
Yeah.
So clearly with this one, you're special because you're the man, Ryan.
I don't know.
So we started going through the podcast without doing that piece.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So we're gonna roll with some of these rapid fire questions.
Yeah.
What is one hidden talent you have?
I can juggle.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I used to be able to do four. I recently tried at my kids' baseball practice and could only get three, but when I was playing baseball in college, as anyone who's played baseball knows, you have a lot of downtime when you play baseball. And I could do four then. It would take practice, but yeah, I can juggle three right now.
Okay, this is not part of the rapid fire. What position did you play in college?
I went as a catcher and realized very quickly that I would have to sit the bench for a couple of years if I stayed a catcher, but there was an open position in the outfield, so I played outfield for all 4 years.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I would not have pegged you for a catcher.
That was kind of the issue, was I was just a little too big. So I'm 6'4", and you know, it's tough to get out of the position. You're a little slower. In high school, it was fine. I had a strong arm, and I was really good at calling a game. I was really, really good at calling a game. And then when I got to college and I realized, one, I don't get to call the game anymore. The coach calls the game. There were two junior catchers ahead of me, so I would have had to sit, and I wasn't necessarily defensively better than them. I could hit better, but I wasn't defensively better, so I wasn't going to get on the field as much. And the coach was like, well, because you can hit, can you play center? And I was like, shit, I can. So I learned center real fast and played outfield for most of the rest of my career. Yeah.
There you go. Interesting. Well, the next question is, where is one place you've been that you just don't want to go back to?
Ooh, man, there's a lot of those. Bowling Green?
Bowling Green.
No, there's nothing wrong with Bowling. It's just very small and hard to get to. I don't particularly love going to California. Not necessarily just because of politics stuff. It's very hard for me to get to. It's very hard to get in and out of. It's very expensive. And in general, my jokes don't hit because a lot of my jokes probably were funny in the 90s, and seemingly certain audiences don't still find them funny. So when I'm doing talks and stuff, I don't love being out there, because when you make fun of leftists, they get offended. So
yeah, they do. They get offended by a lot.
You can make fun of conservatives. You can make fun of just about anybody else. But you can't make fun of a liberal. So it's not as much fun.
Unless you're Bill Maher, and it worked really, really well for him.
Yeah, he's one of the few that's been able to do it. Yeah. You know, he's one of the few. But, you know, I'm not a comedian by trade. So, you know, so I have to be careful.
What's your guilty pleasure?
Ooh, what's my guilty pleasure? Probably really shitty sci-fi and anything that has to do with conspiracy theories. I love conspiracy theories.
So this Last week been a lot of conspiracy theories.
The last 5 years have been amazing because all the conspiracy theories are coming true. It's so good. It's like, yeah, they did kill Kennedy. Yes, COVID was launched by the Chinese on purpose and Fauci did fund it. Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, it's like, yes, yeah. You're like, okay, wait, all these things are true. Amazing. And then, so what else is true? Let's go. Let's keep going, you know? But I just, I mean, and I say that because I find them intellectually interesting. But, you know, obviously I'm rational enough that know that while some are true, whatever, but most of it is nonsense.
Yeah.
Who is a person that had a surprising impact on your life?
That's a really good question. I'll give you a couple answers because it's probably not just one person, but I'd say since I was divorced 3 years ago, 2022, the relationship that I have with my kids has been even more rewarding than I could have originally imagined. Especially because, you know, not that I'm advocating for divorce. I am not at all. I think it was the right thing to do in our situation. We were just very different people. We're actually, you know, pretty decent friends, get along great today. So it's not even combative or anything. But the massive amount of one-on-one time where, you know, you're developing this very unique and specific relationship that is a little more difficult when there's always another adult there. Not better. I don't mean better in any regard, just so everyone's clear. I just mean that has been more rewarding than I would have imagined. I'll give you an example to that. We were driving home from, I picked my kid up at school the other day and we're driving home and I have them this weekend. And I didn't realize the schedule gets all mixed up and whatever, it's fine. But I didn't realize I had them this weekend. So a few weeks ago, I had scheduled a dinner for Saturday night. And, you know, long story short, my mother's going to come watch them while I go to this dinner. But I said to my kid, I said, I'm sorry. Like, I have to go to this dinner, whatever. And I'm like being apologetic. And he goes, Dad, do you want to go? And I said, yeah, I want to go. He goes, that's all that matters. And I was like, holy shit. Like, I'm doing something right. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know how. Probably not even me. But something here is going right. Because it was just such like a mature, well thought out response to that. Because he knew that he could tell I felt guilty. And basically was giving me the, like, don't feel guilty. And then that, you know, that's probably the best. I'll stop there.
That warms your heart for sure.
That's pretty good. Yeah. What is the hardest thing you've had to overcome?
Rogue Risk was very difficult for me. I don't want to get into details, mostly because I'll probably get sued. But
we don't want that.
No, I don't want that. That's happened too much.
Or we could say, hey, nobody listens to this podcast anyways.
Yeah, I had very big plans. Like, I figured Rogue Risk would be the majority of the rest of my life, or at least a large portion of it. And the way that ended, I was very difficult. It was the first time in my life that I felt listless. I didn't see it coming. I didn't have another plan. I didn't have anything else that I wanted to do. I felt like I was honestly still just getting started. And when that opportunity was no longer there, I guess we can say, I had no idea what I wanted to do next in my life. And that is, I think people may romanticize that as being very freeing. And to a certain extent, that's true. But it wasn't for me. It terrorized me because I felt like I didn't have a purpose. And I've realized that for me personally, purpose and meaning in what I do is very important. It's very important. If anytime I've been in a job or in a position where the work does not have purpose or meaning, my efficiency or my whatever drops to almost zero. And right. I just didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know how to help people. I had to make money. I didn't know how to at that time because I just didn't know what I wanted to do, right? And I was worried. And then there's also this piece that comes in where, look, if you look over my career, right? Like, I was at the Murray Group and, you know, ended that, was at Trusted Choice, got fired from there, was at Bold Penguin. That didn't work out for reasons that weren't really Bold Penguin or my fault. I had a family member get terminally ill. Then I went and became the CEO of this fitness franchise because I couldn't travel and I needed a job locally. That ended abruptly. Then I have Rogue. That ends abruptly. You know, and I'm like going, oh my God, like what is wrong with me? You know, like why is my career taking this path? Like I've done all these amazing things, but don't really have an accumulating asset that captures all these things and experiences that I've had. So I feel like I'm not reaping value from these experiences. And it was just it was a much more challenging existential time than I probably would have thought. And it was debilitating for a while. I mean, I went to be honest with you, I went to a pretty dark place for a while. I put on like 15 pounds and just didn't know who I wanted to be. And made a lot of excuses for myself, like all the things that like I wouldn't have equated to myself. Here's the lesson that I learned there. We need to mentally prepare before the bad thing happens, right? And I would have thought I was mentally prepared, but what I realized is I hadn't done enough work yet, right? Like I still have more work to do on myself because I have to assume that it's possible that that kind of thing could happen again. And what I don't want to have happen is if something like that does happen again, that I go through the same 9-month period of fucking wallowing in my basement, woe is me-ing, and, you know, why me? Why can't I do this? Well, you know, all the nonsense that I would coach somebody out of, right? Like, I couldn't coach myself out of it. I hadn't mentally prepared enough. So I'm obviously fixing that as now. A lot of the writing I do is as much talking to other people as it's talking to myself, reinforcing the ideas that have helped me become successful. But that was one of the harder, there have been other hard times in my life, but that was definitely one of the darkest, hardest moments was that post-Rogue period.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
One person, either dead or alive, you would love to have one more meal with.
Ooh.
Any time, any person in history.
Living would be Jordan Peterson.
That's a good one.
Dead would be Winston Churchill.
Why those?
Yeah.
I don't know that there is a single person living today with the intellectual honesty of Jordan Peterson. I don't think he's always right. I'm not saying that but I think that he is the standard bearer for intellectual honesty. And what I mean by that is he is always sharing what he believes is his most accurate truth, regardless of the consequences at all times, at least as far as I can tell, right? I mean, obviously I've met him. I've been to two of his events and actually paid for the VIP for one and got to spend some time. Amazing. I mean, you know, essentially in the maybe 15 minutes that we got to interact as a group and individually, there was no indications that he was anything other than exactly the way he comes off. I sat front row at the event. There was nothing about, but the way he performs an event to me is unlike how really anyone else does it. And if you've never seen him talk, and maybe you've only seen him online, et cetera, what he does is he takes an idea, you know, what is truth, right? Some big idea. And then for an hour and a half, he in real time works through that question in his head, in real time in front of you. So every performance is a unique performance. It is, you are getting his most relevant, most real time thought on that particular topic. And he'll question it and he'll go down a path and then he'll get to a certain point. And if he doesn't believe or think that the argument is valid, he'll back all the way out and start again down a different path. And you're watching this in real time, this guy work through an idea to try to get to what he believes is truth. And that's what opens him up to be clipped and taken out of context and used to say he's a racist and all these things that literally have no meaning anymore, unfortunately, because we've used them so much. You know, but to know, because he's smart enough to know and been in the game long enough to know that there are people literally watching every move he makes to misclip him, right? Just like they do with Elon, just like they do with Trump, just like they do with anybody, right? They're looking to misclip him, right? Mm-hmm. But he still engages in the practice because he knows it's the only way to get to his truth. And that to me is just, I don't know that there's a more admirable quality. Winston Churchill, because I feel like, I just feel like he was one of the most dynamic personalities, and he was the perfect personality for the moment in time in which he was called, mm-hmm. right? Not a perfect human. And somehow today you got assholes online acting like Winston Churchill isn't a hero of World War II, which is absolutely fucking bonkers. You know, he's this and he hated these guys. And literally bombs are dropping on his people's heads every night. The dude was survival. Right. But he navigated it and he did what he had to do. And if you really dig into, I mean, yeah, not perfect. Did he say things that, you know, people today can take out of context because it doesn't fit our current culture? For sure. Right. But in that moment, he was the only human who could have navigated that for the British people and ultimately for the Allies. And I just think you don't get a lot of people who are the perfect person for a world-changing moment. You just, that doesn't happen very often. And he was certainly one of those individuals. And I don't know, I find him fascinating.
That is pretty fascinating. It's with Jordan Peterson, how you were describing him. I think it's awesome to see people, how they use their brain, going through thoughts and going through a debate. Very eloquently winding in other facts and figures and et cetera. A lot like what Charlie Kirk did. And I think it would have, going back and seeing all of his clips for the past week, I think he was brilliant.
Yeah.
His mind worked so much differently than anybody I've ever known. But I think how he could go onto a college campus, knowing what he's going through, what it was going to come to him, I think that was just so brilliant on how he could do that.
To me, Charlie Kirk, the reason that he was killed, and I believe he was killed, that this was not some random 22-year-old who just decided to go grab a Mauser and climb up on the top of a building. I have literally no evidence to back that up. That's just... Doesn't seem to make sense.
That's where we go back to, you know, 5 minutes ago where you talked about
conspiracy theory part. Yeah.
This is where this is coming in.
Yeah. But here's why I think he was killed. Charlie Kirk was reintroducing God into people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And my personal belief is the reason our society is in the divisive place that it is today is because so many people have given up on God. And they have, you know, you've heard this phrase from, I think it was Nietzsche, God-shaped hole in your heart. Maybe it may not be Nietzsche, but the quote is accurate. You have an entire segment of our population who have either through being taught this or just not ever being exposed to what spirituality actually is, right? They can only see the Catholic priests doing, you know, unspeakable things. They can't see that that's man, not God, right? They associate the two together.
Right. Okay.
So this God-shaped hole in people's heart gets filled with something, and it's being filled with, you know, crazy ideas and you know, like the way that I believe that God exists, right? Someone else believes that a man can be born a man and decide to become a woman and that somehow they're now a woman. That's a bananas thought. There's literally no reality to back up that thought. That's just anatomy. I mean, that's biology. That doesn't mean that person shouldn't have rights. It doesn't mean that person shouldn't be treated fairly. It doesn't mean that that person shouldn't have an equal place in our society with everyone else, but they're not a woman. They're just not, right? And that idea is only possible if you have decided to step outside of reality and start filling the hole in your heart with concepts that aren't of God. And what Charlie Kirk was, what he was doing was bringing our youth back to faith, right? Without a denomination. He didn't push Catholicism. He believed, he was a believer, and he was showing people, and you can see it in some of those clips, right? You have transgender people coming up and you can tell they have hate for him when they get up to the mic. And by the time they walk away, maybe they still don't appreciate him or like him, which is completely fair, but they don't hate him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And all of a sudden, that's love. That's God. Now, all of a sudden, they got this little infection of love and peace and God inside them that goes, wait a minute. I expected to show up and experience this hateful interaction. And instead, what I got was maybe not necessarily agreement, but I got love, respect back. Maybe there's another way. Right. Maybe I can still believe what I believe, right? Or be who I want to be, but also live in God's love. And what that does, when I don't want to get too conspiracy theory, but if you think about it, right? Like I think it was, who was it that wrote The End of History? Oh my gosh, there's a whole idea that history ended after World War II, that there would never be big wars anymore, all this kind of stuff, right? That we had ascended as human beings to a level where, and it's just simply not true. It's complete fallacy. It's postmodern bullshit nonsense. Like, there's no receipts for that. We are the same humans, right, who were throwing spears at each other 100,000 years ago. We're exactly the same. Our brains are wired exactly the same. We still want power. We still want control. We still have egos. We still want to protect our family. We still want status. We still want all these things because that's what keeps you alive. Okay.
Right.
All right. Now, that being said, the way that we've managed this for more than 2,000 years is through God and particularly Judeo-Christian values, in my opinion. I do think there's a lot of merit to some Eastern religions as well, which I actually think are just, I have a whole philosophy that I won't get into for another time because it's way too contextual on the Eastern religions. But to me, the Eastern religions were just, are this, to me, the same God that taught us Christianity is what they're talking about in the Eastern religions. It was just how that segment of humanity needed to accept these messages, because at their core, they're almost exactly the same, right? Different ways, spun a little differently, presented a little differently. Most of the Eastern religions, if you were to lay them over the top of Christianity and take a step back, would be almost indiscernible. So, you know, I think many of the, you know, whatever. Like, I have this argument with my mom all the time. I'm like, so you're telling me every Japanese person prior to 1815 when Christianity hit the island is just fucked? That's not the God I know. You know what I mean? Like, you know, come on. Like, you know, I don't, whatever. But my point in saying that is, like, this divisiveness, if you're of God, we can disagree and still love each other and respect each other. But the powers that be can't control you. So if we can disagree, Ryan, if you and I can vehemently disagree on a topic, but still have respect, trust, and love for each other because we're of God, we can't be controlled.
Right.
But if one of us doesn't have God and hates the other, and I allow that hate to infect me or vice versa, right? Now we can be controlled, because now I can say, Ryan, it's Hanley's fault that you're where you are. And someone could say to me, it's Tubner's fault that you're where you are, right? And now I can be controlled and manipulated and pushed. That's why God's being removed from our society. Because if we all are spiritual and living in that place and can disagree, but disagree in a respectful and loving way as much as is possible, right? We can't be controlled. And that's mm-hmm. not what the people who push the world want it to be.
You mentioned something earlier about the generation. I've got two boys, 15 and 12, and I coached them in basketball when they're little, because that's the sport I loved the most growing up. And we were, and I tell them all the time, like, you are manifesting, or you're part of a generation that has been told that you're great and that you deserve everything and that you should get a trophy. And we didn't win a game. And like, this guy handed me a bunch of little medals to give the boys, and I just threw them in the trash. He goes, what are you doing? I was like, winners get trophies, losers get better. And one little boy started crying. I'm like, no, we didn't win. We won one game. You don't win a trophy for winning one game. You win a trophy for winning the most games. Like, I'm not going to allow you to get a trophy and feel happy about yourself because we were terrible. That's my failure as a coach and not making you better. And you need to, we need to work harder the next year to get better, to win more games. And that, and if we do, I'll celebrate you, but I'm not going to celebrate you because you lost. It's a learning opportunity.
Yeah. Entitlement is, it's a tool, in my position again, is, entitlement and pushing entitlement is another mechanism of removing God from people's lives because it's very selfish, right? If I deserve something because I showed up and I'm breathing air and I'm here, or, you know, I'm this tall or I'm this color or I, you know, from this town or whatever, right? Like, that's a selfish thing. That's me. That's putting me first. Me, mine. I want. I showed up. I get. Why do I get? Why does he get and I don't get? Well, he hit 400 and you hit 125. That's why he hits third in the lineup.
Get better.
Well, my kid, but no, your kid hits 125. He's hitting at the end of the lineup. That kid hits 400. That's why he hits three, right? But today's society teaches we should all be equal. We're not equal. Sorry, we're not equal. There are things that the two of you can do that I could never do. There's things that I could do that the two of you can't do, and that's what life is, right? Like I should be better than the two of you at something, and the two of you should be better. You know what I mean? Like, that's the way the world works. And if instead of jealousy and entitlement and these type of like very self-oriented, very selfish things, if we did not celebrate them, if we celebrated achievement instead, an opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets better. But that's right. Very hard to sell because opportunity and achievement mean there's a chance for you to suck.
Yeah.
And nobody today wants to suck. Because you have politicians on both sides of the aisle who, for their own selfish reasons, are willing to say, I'll give you that thing you want, even though you didn't earn it, if you put me in a position of power. And why? So there's no incentive for me to prioritize opportunity and achievement when I know if I vote for this guy over here or I support this person here, I'm going to get what I want anyways.
Right.
And that's the society we have. We have a society today where the vast majority of people just want to be given their due, and then they're still going to complain because this is the thing with UBI. Look, well, we're way off topic here, but like my issue with UBI is let's say everybody gets a $1,500 check every month. Well, now all that happened is zero, right? Everyone got zero. They still just have zero because all that's going to happen is everything we buy is going to get $1,500 a person more expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's all that's going to happen. You're not going to have more, right? I mean, like, you're not going to have, well, so few people understand about inflation and monetary policy and all this kind of shit, but like that does not help people. Opportunity helps people. And that's the hard thing. That's the thing nobody wants to do. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to go into a trailer park full of white trash white people or a ghetto full of black people. No one wants to go in there and do the really hard work of getting those people opportunity to become what they're capable of becoming. They just say, here, I'll send you all something, vote for me, and you'll be a little happier because, you know, you'll feel like you got something for free. And it's not just those communities. It's all communities, right? But like, obviously some communities are kind of naturally given more opportunity than others. Sure. And what I think is just so incredibly dishonest by our political class is this purposefully conflating equity and opportunity. They're purposefully conflating those two things. Opportunity is everybody who tries out for the team starts at 0 points, and based on what they do, get points towards being on the team or whatever, right? I mean, obviously take that in context, right? They get a chance to make the team equally, not because of their dad, not because they're their brother's an alumnus, not because of anything other than this kid did. These 12 kids were the 12 best kids, and they made the basketball team, right? That's opportunity.
Yeah.
Equity is the 30 kids that tried out. We're gonna give 12 of them a slot on the A team, and we're going to give 12 of them a slot on this team, and we're going to give five of them a slot, and then we're going to tell them they're all equal and they're all going to get trophies. And now the kids on the C team, they're not happy anyways because they're like, I want to be on the fucking A team.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're not good enough to be on the A team. But they don't learn that lesson because they still got a fucking slot on the team.
Yep.
That's why the
Michael Jordan, right? Michael Jordan. I mean, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you guys. But Michael Jordan got his freshman year of high school, didn't make the fucking basketball team. Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
Do you think Michael Jordan is Michael Jordan today if he makes his freshman basketball team? No. Yeah. He has said in every interview that it was not making that team that became the primary and proving that coach wrong. I mean, he's still, and I think in his Hall of Fame speech, he mentioned the coach that cut him in high school. That's how much that put a chip on his shoulder that drove him to become the greatest basketball player of all time, yeah. Right? Oh, so, like, we need losses. Our kids need to lose. They need to lose. Not should, they need to. They have to feel what that's like. What does it feel like to have your dick knocked in the dirt by somebody?
Get up.
And now you got to, who are you? Are you the type of person that gets back up or not? And if you're not, are you willing to learn how to become the person that gets back up? And if you ultimately decide to be the person that stays in the dirt, you now need to accept your position as someone who will not have power, influence, or status in the community because you made that conscious decision not to capture the opportunity. So, firm believer in exactly what you said, Wes, in about 15 minutes of diatribe.
Well, it's good. Like I had a post on LinkedIn about a year ago. My oldest, who was an eighth grader, was playing, and their school's really small. So there were seventh graders playing up as eighth graders, and they were just getting just dominated because some of you seventh graders at the time were small. And it was a close game. They were playing a team that was way more physically gifted than them, but they were beating them because they outworked them. My oldest decided to take a chance, and it failed. He got a block called on him. The kid stepped up, made the two free throws. They lost the game. And that wasn't the moment that they lost the game. And there were 700 different things that happened during the game, bad passes, bad screens, bad shots. But after the game, he was heartbroken. And someone's like, hey, bud, life has consequences for decisions. You took a shot, which I love, the fact that you're willing to stand up and take a shot when no one else was. It didn't work out. But that's a great lesson. Now you know that life has consequences for your decisions. And all decisions will result in victory or failure. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you're willing to stand up and take a shot tells me who you are, and I love that about you. It's a great time to learn it. Eighth grade is a great time to learn a lesson about victory and defeat. It's a lot harder when you're 40-something years old. Those defeats hurt way worse at 40 than they do at 30.
It's so if you can take the emotions out of wins and losses, which we're not taught emotional maturity at all, right? We'll teach them about 17th century French culture, but we won't teach them how to manage their emotions in school. But they're just data points. That's what I tell. So my son's a pitcher, right? My son's a pitcher. And last summer, he gave up his first home run, 11-year-old baseball. And this kid just absolutely smoked the ball off him. Hung a changeup. And this ball still might be going, right? I mean, this kid just absolutely hit a piss missile, honestly. And he puts his head down and he looks at me and I shrug and I go, don't hang 2-0 changeups. And he like gives me this look, like he's got this look that he gives me that's kind of like, fuck you, dad. And then, but I also, then he smiled. And once the kid came around and touched the plate, you know, I went out to talk to him and I just said, hey, guess what? If you're going to be a pitcher, that ain't the last home run you're going to give up, bro. So now you know what it feels like, right? And my reason for telling that story is he's a better pitcher just in the 4 months since he gave up that first home run because he gave up the home run. He now knows 2-0, don't hang a changeup. Probably don't throw a changeup there, but don't hang one because it's most likely going to get freaking pounded. And that's a lesson that he had to learn the hard way. If that kid swings and misses or hits a little dinky ground, he don't learn that lesson. But the fact that that kid sent that thing to the moon, it's now burned into his brain. Hanging 2-0 changeups is a bad idea, right? Mm-hmm. That's a, you know, so it's just, they're data points. So that's what I teach my kids. I'm like, it's a data point, bro. It's a data point. Like, it's just one, you now know one thing that you didn't know before. You didn't lose. You're going to get to play baseball again, right? Like, it's just a data point. And, you know, I think, you know, that has worked. My kids have fairly decent emotional maturity. We just had another kid. The opposite of that is this other pitcher we have. He gave up his first home run last week. And again, just absolute monster shot. He takes his glove, spikes it, picks it up, stomps on it 3 times with 2 feet, and then punts it over first base before the kid hits home. Needless to say, that was the last pitch he threw in that game. But that would be the opposite of not understanding that these are just data points and that, you know,
yeah,
that's what it is.
That would be the complete opposite.
Yes, that would be the opposite, yeah.
Yeah, so our kids are, our daughter is in gymnastics, competitive gymnastics and jiu-jitsu. She's really good.
She's gonna be a badass.
So there's one meet I remember. It was last year, I think it was. She fell twice on beam. And so, you know, you fall twice on beam, you're getting, what, 7? And I think she did. I think she got one of her lowest meets ever. And it was a data point, as you were saying. I mean, she went back. She's, you know, sulked that for about an hour. Beth gave her about an hour. She sulked, drove back, got back to work. She rocked it out. State champ, regional champ. I mean, she did great last year. Same with jiu-jitsu. She goes to her first tournament in a couple, I think it was last year. She loses to this girl in no-gi, but she learns. And so she's got her again this upcoming tournament, so she knows how to compete against her. Yeah. So it's just all data points.
You know, something you said in there that I think is a really important point, and I think this goes for adults too, not just children. One of the things that I teach my kids with sports, because I'm a very reactionary person. Like, you know, when someone says something stupid to me, I have two thoughts going in my head. One is you're retarded and I can't stand you. And the other is like, oh, okay, man. You know, that's what actually comes out of my face, right? I've gotten better at my reactions. So I was very reactionary and, you know, that came with a lot of consequences in high school sports. Now, different time, different era, right? So like, mm-hmm. If you reacted poorly, your coach would just like throw you against the fence and call you an asshole and then put you back on the field. Today, it's a little different. You know, you got to like go sit in front of the board or whatever. But my point is what you said about your daughter where she sulked for an hour, right?
Mm-hmm.
That time is important. And what I tell them is you're not a robot, right? Yes, it's a data point. No, do you want to take your glove and punt it over the first baseman's head? No, you don't. You don't. That's not the reaction we're looking for.
Mm-mm.
But a solid motherfucker under your breath, go get it. Because I know I feel better when I do that, right? Like I snap hook one into the woods. Mother. Bah! And then you let yourself go. You know, you get it. You expunge the demon.
Yep.
You let yourself shake it out and then you hit it again. And you know, as the golf gods, because they just love to mess with us, it will most likely be 305 right down the middle with a nice little sculpted draw, you know, into the perfect position, hitting 4, you know, instead of 2. But you know, that release of energy is important. And I think the flip side of this entitlement piece is we've also throttled their emotional release, right? Mm-hmm. Because toxic masculinity, you know, the whole thing, like I let my kids curse, okay? In the right scenarios, in the right situation, I don't care if you curse. I curse, obviously. But I've said to them, look, if you're at school or you're in church or, you know, you curse in the wrong scenario, I ain't coming to bail you out. So that you gotta, with great power comes great responsibility. However, part of the reason that I let them curse is a venting mechanism, right? It's a word they're not supposed to say, that for whatever reason, these words come to us when we're angry. And if you can vent them out in the right way, like in the dugout or into your glove or under your breath quickly or someplace that's healthy that allows you to get that emotion out of your body and re-engage, that's really powerful. So while we don't want the over emotional reaction to the negative thing, they're gonna have a reaction. We have to let them vent that, right?
Yeah.
They can't watch Paul O'Neill, you know, murder a water cooler, you know, after he strikes out in the playoffs, which is shown a million every time the Yankees make the playoffs, and expect them. This is natural human stuff. So I think it's just managing through these things and understanding that like we never want to swing too far one way or the other, right? That you know, understanding how our body reacts to things, going all the way back to the peak thing, right? Managing our energy, being aware, being able to recalibrate, being present in the moment, right? Like these things are tools to help us navigate these, but we can't fight humanity, but we also want to live in reality, if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Really good stuff.
I think that makes perfect sense, personally.
Yeah. Well, Well, it's been a great conversation. Probably went everywhere and anywhere we could have hoped it could have been. I've enjoyed it. Like, this has been
a great
hour and a half.
Yeah, so, it really has. It's been. I didn't even realize it had been an hour and a half.
I only needed one bathroom break. I mean, when you got this size bladder like your son does.
Yeah, don't travel with Tunger if you're wondering. There's a lot of bathroom breaks on the road. Yeah. Well, everybody, thank you guys.